Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Al Cornelius, and I am, thank you God, a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's a pleasure and an honor indeed to be here this morning with you marshmallows. And I say that advisedly because you see all the tough drunks are out there this morning dying. Those tough drunks are out there dying, and we don't have to. Thank God we can be in here together this morning. And it's always a tremendous honor and a true privilege to be with you, people like you, in rooms like this on Sunday morning. Because at least to me, there's something very special about being here. There's something very respectable about being here. If there's anything on earth that people like us need, it's a sense of respectability. And so it's a true honor for me to be here this morning. And I want to thank the people of the state of Idaho, my home group. I'm up here so much I kind of think of this as my home group. But I want to thank the people of Idaho for allowing me to be here this morning. I want to thank Deanne and Steve for their sharing last night. I want to thank my friend Natalia, who picked out a necktie for me. And I'm not good at things like that, you see. And I just want to thank you all for letting me be a part of this thing. I want to make a couple of things clear before I go too far. First and foremost, I am not an AA speaker. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. AA speakers are indeed a different breed of bird. You know, you can depend on them to say all the right things at the right time, and they're sort of stable and responsible. I'm not too stable, on the other hand. I was crying while John was reading the steps, and, you know, I'm not too stable, and I'm not famous anywhere except right here, I guess, with me. I finally found out yesterday what constitutes being a biggie speaker. I think that we can say that we have really arrived in the big time when we get the opportunity to have our picture taken standing alongside Joe Clemens. But I'm not a big timer as a speaker. I go around talking to AA meetings here and there, and I have a lot of fun, and I know a lot of love, and I experience some miracles here and there and now and then. And over this weekend, I've had some moments of miracles, some moments of touching the souls of other human beings, and some moments mystical and magical, and they're so wonderful. And I'm so glad to be here. But I am not an AA speaker. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would like it also made very, very clear that I'm not this morning going to discuss any issues. The members of Broccoli Anonymous have some serious problems, I know, and God knows that the children of broccoli addicts have some major issues to discuss, but I don't think that this is the appropriate arena to discuss issues, so I'm not going to talk about any of those this morning. I think that my business here today is to treat my alcoholism. Not to have my alcoholism treated, but to treat my alcoholism by participating in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the sharing of my experience, strength, and hope, such as it may be. And I also believe that I'm chartered and responsible here this morning for trying to help one person in this room believe that I have been where they have been, that I have walked the lonely streets, that I have dreamed the drunken dreams. And I believe that I'm charged this morning with trying to help some person in this room to believe that as of today, thanks to God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm making it. I need to help one person in this room believe that I'm making it. You know, I'm not rich and famous, but I'm wearing breeches that have never been peed in, and I've got on boots that have never been puked on, and I'm wearing brand new, right out of the box underwear. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm making it this morning. And maybe most of all, I think that I'm responsible this morning to to try to help some one person within this room to believe that I believe. Because, you see, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I believed in God, but I couldn't get a handle on the idea that God was on my side. And I was lucky enough to get involved with a bunch of people. I call them the guys. And one day they said, hey, it doesn't matter whether you believe in God, just so long as you can believe that we believe. Much later, they told me that it didn't really matter whether they believed, so long as I believed that they believed. But in the beginning, they said, you know, you don't have to believe, just believe that we believe. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm standing here this morning safe, sane, and sober, and I believe, and I hope that you can believe that I believe. Now, it may be that there's one or two people in this room that's a little doubtful. You know, you may even be so precise as to say this is a terrible mistake being here. And if you're a little doubtful, that's okay. We all had some reservations coming here. You see, I didn't come here because alcohol quit working. You know, people for whom alcohol quits working don't come here. They don't have to. You know, the idea that you quit drinking because alcohol has quit working makes perfect sense to a non-alcoholic. But it doesn't make any sense to people like us. So, say, I want you to understand that I'm not here this morning out of any kind of virtue. I didn't come here because it quit working. I came here just because I couldn't drink anymore. And today, thanks be to the love of God and the ongoing care and concern of people like you in rooms like this, I'm standing here sober. And that's what I'm to talk about this morning, to share with you some of those things that have happened to me in my search for it. I was thinking here earlier about how Jimmy Ryan used to say that he was standing there clear of eye and steady of hand and sweet of breath. God, doesn't that tell the story? Doesn't that tell the story? Steve said it last night, this beats the L.A. County Jail. You know, steady of hand. I'm an alcoholic. An alcoholic is a guy that doesn't need a drink till he's had one. An alcoholic is a guy that can quit any darn time he wants to. And as long as he is absolutely convinced that he can quit any time he wants to, he can't. But there comes a moment of truth and clarity when he understands that he can't quit. And somehow magically in that moment he can. An alcoholic is a guy that walks into a bar, he's got a sign on the wall that says, all you can drink, $5. He says, give me $10 for it. An alcoholic is a guy like me that used, abused, corrupt, and betrayed every person he touched. Breached the commandments and pound for pound, puked as much as anybody in this room. And got lucky. Got over here on the sunny side of the street that Norm used to talk about. I'm so sorry that we have lost so many of our heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous. Guys like old Norm that talked about getting out of that land of booze, illusion, and broken dreams and getting over here on the sunny side of the street. Guys like Chuck and Eddie Reagan. We used to have a lot of heroes in AA, and I don't think we have enough heroes anymore, and I wish we had some of them. At any rate, Norm talked about the sunny side of the street, and I got lucky, and I got over here, and I'm an alcoholic. People that study people like us, and every time I say that, I kind of want to look up at the big microscope. Feel like a damn microbe on a slide, you know. people who study people like us, we are emotionally immature. Now, I don't know what that means to you, but it means to me that I can't get a handle most of the time on the idea that there's a thing called cause and effect. I kick you in the ankle, and you hit me in the nose, and I blame her. That's how people like us think. emotionally immature. We can't get a handle on the idea that we're responsible to us, for us, and if we send it out pretty, it comes back pretty. We can't get a handle on that idea at all. That's what people that study us say. People that study us also say that we are self-centered in the extreme. And that means to me that even after a considerable number of years of sobriety, I still lead a life that is essentially based on various degrees of obsession with I, me, mine, more, now, and I'm sorry. And they say that we're maladaptive, and that means we don't fit. You know, I just don't fit. I expect them to understand me. And as long as I do that, I don't fit. So I'm maladaptive. They also incidentally say that we're guilty. I don't know what you're guilty of. I grew up on a sheep ranch. I listened with great interest the other night when John was talking about his opportunity for spiritual enlightenment and awareness while he was out in the desert herding a bunch of woolies. And, you know, if you can find a guy that can find enlightenment while he's herding a bunch of woolies out there in the Idaho desert, better listen to him. I've got a few other problems, too. I'm not good at relationships, but I can't stand my own company. I don't do idleness very well, but I'm not good at looking for work. And as Paul O says, I've got a body that can't drink and a brain that says I got to. Now, if you take that bunch of characteristics and that bunch of experiences, mix them all together, throw in a little booze, then you're likely to get a trip to Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous, that's show and tell for big folks. Alcoholics Anonymous, that's when you've been out there for a half a lifetime looking for the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. You finally get there, and instead of a pot of gold, it's a crock of crap. You come in here, you're stripped of your illusions, you got nowhere else to go, and that's Alcoholics Anonymous. And Alcoholics Anonymous is a place where I'm sitting there looking across the room at a red-headed biker, and he's an ugly sucker, and I'm looking at that guy, and I realize I've been looking at old Red for a number of years, and I don't know him well enough to know his last name. And I certainly don't know him well enough to loan him $20. But as I'm sitting there looking at him, I understand right down to my toenails that if I'm hanging on at 4 o'clock in the morning and I can't make it, that I can trust my life to that guy. I don't know that sucker well enough to loan him $20, and yet I know that I can trust my life to him, and that's Alcoholics Anonymous. And if there's anyone here that has never contemplated a major act of faith, I suggest you look at the idea that people like us do on a regular basis, trust our lives into the hands of people like us. That is, I submit, ladies and gentlemen, the greatest miracle, the greatest act of faith you're ever going to see. That people like us would trust our lives to people like us. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. I started my life on a sheep ranch up in the corner of Wyoming, up Crook County. I had good people. They treated me right. There was no dysfunction around that bunch. You know, they were okay. They were fine people. And they loved me and they took care of me and I was ashamed of them. They loved me and they took care of me and they were fine people and I was ashamed of them. And I don't know why, and it's the cross I yet bear. It's a cross I yet bear because they were good people. And I was ashamed of them. And then all of a sudden, I realized here a few years ago, looking back, that as a little guy, I had been contemplating me. First time in my life that I remember any self-contemplation. And I remember that I recognized that I was different. And I was second class. And if I had known what the word was, I would have said I was a jerk. And I'm a little tiny guy. You know, and I'm different. And I'm second class. And I'm a jerk. I was ashamed of my people who were good to me. It was the custom of the time and the era, the time and the place, that in the winter months, because you didn't have any schools out there on the sheep ranch, during the winter months, then you'd go into a town nearby to go to school. And came time for me to start the fourth grade, my sister's to start high school. We moved into a little town of western South Dakota so that we could go to school. Mother and the kids went to town. And once again, I came to understand that I was different. Because, you see, I got into school and I started the fourth grade there, and I found out that the other kids had learned to read by reading out of a book. Guffey's Reader or something. C-A-T spells cat. Little Sam watched the dog run, you know. They had learned to read out of a book in conventional manner. And I was different because I had learned to read walking the several aisles of a little tiny old-time country store, reading the labels off the containers there, you know, the Arbuckle's coffee and Pettyjohn cereal and pork and beans and stuff like that. I had learned to read in this little country store. And I was different from the rest of the kids. And people like us, you know, don't handle different well. You know, we're not good at different. And I felt different. I got along well in school, even though I was different, second class, isolated, a jerk. I was all these things. But I got along well in school because I was cursed with a certain amount of brightness. I say cursed because people that are smart enough have a tough time with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. They have a tough time with life itself most of the time. But I was a fairly bright kid, and I got along well in school. I didn't learn anything. I had a brother, went to the same school, went to the same classes, and he knows a lot of stuff, and he's not very smart at all. He's a very decent human being, but he's not very smart. We went to the same school. He knows a ton of stuff because he had to study. I didn't, and I didn't learn a darn thing there. But I went to school, and then one afternoon, October 1940, I found myself in a biology class with a lady named Hazel, and Hazel and I were whacking up a frog or something, and we were talking, and she told me how she and some of the guys had gone out the night before. They drank some wine. They'd had fun. That was exactly 50 years ago, and I still don't know what fun is, but she told me that they had gone out, they drank some wine, they'd had fun. It sounded like the right thing to do. No, it didn't occur to me that none of my peers, with the obvious exception of Hazel, drank. It didn't occur to me that I had not, prior to that, drank. It didn't occur to me that I was in the only town in 400 miles where you had to be 21 to buy booze. None of these things crossed my mind. It simply seemed like the right thing to do. You know, and then I asked her the big question. I said, how much does it cost? And she said, 50 cents a quart. Now, in 1940, ladies and gentlemen, you could buy darn 50 cents a quart. I had a dollar somehow or another. I made a deal that evening with a guy named Travis, who later became a very substantial member of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I made a deal with a guy named Travis. He made the run. He brought back 2 quarts of Muscatel, and my life hadn't been the same from that moment to this. You know, that Muscadoodle hit bottom, and it did what it was supposed to do. You know, Steve said it last night. It took the hard corners off things. You know, it did what it was supposed to do. And the next morning, I got up. I was terribly, terribly sick, and I wanted more. That's the way it is. God, from that moment on, that's the way it was. I don't know to this day that I've ever ran into anything, really, that worked better than Muscatel. The Christian Brothers up in Northern California used to make... Now, I know that none of you will relate to this because you're real alcoholics that never drank cream sherry, but the Christian Brothers up in Central California used to make an extremely fine cream sherry that did it just about as good as Muscatel did. Turpenhydrate did it pretty good, too, occasionally. Aren't too many people here, I don't think, that drank any turpenhydrate, but turpenhydrate did it pretty good. Vodka and Percodan does it pretty good, too, as a matter of fact. But you know, that muscadoodle did it right. It did it right. From that moment on, what time did I start? Anyhow, from that moment on, alcohol was a part of my life. I had a friend named Rip that lived out of town a little ways, and he would drive to town to school in his pickup. He had a nice little Plymouth pickup with a green body and black fenders, and we used to keep a bottle of Imperial in the glove compartment. And when school got a little too much for us, then we'd go out to the pickup, we'd take a hit or two of that Imperial, and we'd make it. And, you know, alcohol was a part of my life. And by the time I'm 17, I was a trouble drunk. And at 19, I hit my first psycho ward. When I say first psycho ward, obviously there were some other psycho wards, but at the age of 19, I hit my first psycho ward. I was in the Army, and I was at a place called Fort MacArthur, California, in San Pedro, and I had been there for quite a little time. They didn't quite know what to do with me, and so I got drunk a lot. And, I hear bands playing when there weren't any bands playing, and there'd be lights flashing, and, things happening. There was a turtle that used to come up out of the floor, disappear in the ceiling, and I'd watch him a lot, you know, gave me a lot of company. And I, incidentally, over the years, I have talked to a lot of dipsomaniacs, and dipsomaniacs are supposed to see pink elephants and see snakes, and I've run into very, very few people that saw snakes, and I never saw anybody that hallucinated over a pink elephant, but I've known quite a few people that saw turtles. As one guy said that he used to look at this turtle, it was kind of square-shaped, looked kind of like a Jack Daniels bottle. And anyhow, I saw this turtle, and I began to get a little bit scared, and I put my put my mind to the problem, and I quickly ran over to the medical department and told them that I had to have help. I was going queer. And they didn't think too much of that idea either. And incidentally, if that word's offensive to anyone here, I'm sorry. It just happens to be a word that was used in that era. And at any rate, I didn't... they didn't think much of the idea, but I got their attention. So they threw me into an ambulance and hauled me off to Pasadena, where they had an Army Regional Hospital. And they had taken over a great old hotel and converted it into a hospital. And they hauled me up there, and I was in a pretty bad shape. And they took me in, and I remember that they asked me if I wanted a private room. And I said, yes, I'd like that very much. And so they gave me a private room, and it was strangely furnished. It seemed to be padded all around on the inside, and there wasn't any handle on the door, and there was a grate instead of a window. And during that, little Army nurse came in the evening, and she rubbed my back and gave me hot chocolate. She was nice to me. But during the night, I started convulsing and hallucinating again, and they began to sense that I had fibbed to them about why I was there, and so they sent me over to the drunk ward. Sent me to the drunk ward and let me go bowling two nights a week. And rest of the time, then, we'd occasionally, I'd have appointments with a talking doctor, but most of the time we just bummed around, and I found out that over at the permanent party quarters, you could buy Acme beer for a nickel a bottle. And so I spent a great deal of time over at the permanent party quarters drinking that Acme beer, and 2 days a week we'd go bowling, and about once a month they let us go down to the Rose Bowl and play touch football, and it was quite a thing. And every day now I go to work and I drive past the old Vista Del Arroyo Hotel, which is now a Federal Court of Appeals building. I drive by there every morning, and I start sobriety over again every day when I look at that dumb hotel that had been a hospital and where I'd lived in their drunk ward. But the people there, after a time, took me to a board of competent professionals, and these competent professionals ruled that I was a hopeless alcoholic. I was 19 years old at the time. And they ruled there at Pasadena Hospital that I was a hopeless alcoholic. Now, ladies and gentlemen, many of you know me, and you know that I've got a ton of opinions. And I further will tell you that I do not apologize for having a ton of opinions. I know what the word opinion means. And I also have a few convictions. Now, opinions are subject to change based on new information. Convictions are not. And I have a few convictions, and one of my convictions is that when I was 19 years old, I was not a hopeless alcoholic. Competent professionals said that I was, but I don't believe I was. And I certainly don't believe that I was a hopeless alcoholic when I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, flat guarantee, I'm not a hopeless alcoholic this morning. Hopeless alcoholics don't get to rooms like this. Hopeless alcoholics don't get to rooms like this. You can't bring a hopeless alcoholic in here at the point of a shotgun. Hopeless alcoholics die wherever they are. Doesn't matter whether it's silk sheets or dumpster. Hopeless means bereft of hope, without hope. There ain't none. Hopeless alcoholics never pick up a phone and call Alcoholics Anonymous and say, does your program really work? Hopeless alcoholics don't go to a physician and say, can you heal me? Hopeless alcoholics don't talk to a clergyman and say, can God intervene? Hopeless alcoholics die wherever they are, because that's what hopeless means. And there's not in this room this morning a single hopeless alcoholic. We're here this morning, ladies and gentlemen, because we're not hopeless. We're here this morning because there's payoff. We're here this morning because we believe that somehow or another, being here this morning, offered me that night the right to be there just because I was there with no conditions. Hi, I'm Jim. A little later that evening, I found out, sadly, that Jim was a liar, but, actually, it hurt me deeply. It really wounded me because, you see, Jimmy had been at that time sober for 9 years. And when he said that he had been sober for 9 years, I knew that the man had to be a liar. You know, he had to be a liar because nobody can stay sober for 9 years. And if you're out there this morning and you're wondering about some of us that have been hanging around here half a lifetime, I know how you feel. I wouldn't believe it either. But we're here and we're making it. We're making it in Alcoholics Anonymous. I hung around that Tuesday night National City Group because didn't really have anywhere else to go. I looked at those crummy people there every Tuesday night. I didn't think much of them. I didn't think much of those people at all. But I didn't have anywhere else to go. And then suddenly one evening I looked around the room and they were in their chairs. You ever notice people find their chair, you know, and week after week. One of the places I go to meetings, I sit over by the window, and I call that the sunny side of the street, and people will walk in there, and they'll look to see if the old fool is over there, you know. And I look at those people in their chairs, and Ben was in his chair, and Cal was in his chair, and little Ann was in her chair, and Gracie was in her chair. All the people were in their chairs and they were making it. They were making it. And you know, they were talking about things I didn't understand. They were talking about self-respect and personal pride and having jobs and homes and families. And they were talking about things I didn't understand, and they were sober. They were making it. And I had to accept the collective example of the people in that room. And I began to listen to them. And I began to find out that I really wasn't that different from them. Over the years, I've come to believe that I'm not that different from anyone. Save where alcohol is concerned, I'm not that different from anyone. Guy across the street from me, his name is Rick, and he's a jerk. You know, he's out of step with himself and his God and his fellows. He comes home and he yells at Susanna, kicks the dog. When I'm out of harmony with myself, my God, and my fellows, I'll react in a predictable way. I'll drink whiskey, and having drank whiskey, I won't be able to stop drinking whiskey. Rick and I aren't a penny's worth difference, except I can die of it. When we are out of harmony with ourselves, our God, and our fellows, I don't care whether you're alcoholic, non-alcoholic, or what you are. You're not really any different. But I can die of it. And if you're alcoholic, then I can understand. And I can identify. And I can say, God, I know how you feel. And know that I know how you feel. But I'm not really that different. Thank God I'm not that different from you people in this room this morning. But I began to listen to those people in that room, and I found out that I wasn't that different. And I'd miss a meeting at the Tuesday night National City Group now and then, and one of those suckers come looking for me. There's not a one of those people who could have verbalized John Donne's commentary. You know, a guy named John Donne wrote a thing called For Whom the Bell Tolls. And somewhere in it, it says something to the effect that if a single grain of sand falls into the ocean, the continents diminish. And not one of those people in that Tuesday night National City Group would have verbalized that, but they knew that our strength was in our numbers and in our sticking together and sharing and loving. If I didn't get there on Tuesday night, somebody would come looking for me. And they understood that our business was to treat our alcoholism. And they understood that we dare not abuse our great blessing. They knew that we dare not abuse our great blessing. Today in Alcoholics Anonymous, we've got a lot of people, I call them the poly-anonymous Pollyannas, who are saying, send us your sick, your lame, your halt, give us your housemaid's knee and your fallen arches, and through the miracle of our 12 steps, we'll fix them. And I wonder if this is really good for any of us. First of all, what about our 12 steps? What about our special thing? I want to read something that I think is important about our thing here. Guy says at the very outset, we would like it made ever so clear that AA is a synthetic concept, a synthetic gadget, as it were, drawing upon the resources of medicine, psychiatry, religion, and our own experience of drinking and recovery. You will search in vain for a single new fundamental. We have merely streamlined old and proved principles of psychiatry and religion into such forms that the alcoholic will accept them. And then we have created a society of his very own kind where he can enthusiastically put these very principles to work on himself and other sufferers. Bill Wilson said that there was not a single new principle here. And we talk about this special miracle of ours. I would submit, ladies and gentlemen, that the special miracle of ours is that we understand puking. And it isn't so important what is being shared in these rooms, but who's sharing it? You know, one drunk talking to another. Guy eases up to me and he says, Hal, I got this problem. I'm an armpit sniffer and it's giving me a lot of trouble. And what do you think I ought to do about it? I think you ought to quit doing it. There's no way on earth that I can empathize or understand or have that identity at depth with an armpit sniffer. I don't understand that. And the people in my home group, the people that saved my life, the finest AA group on earth, people in my home group, understood that we had to guard this very, very special blessing. We had to guard it. And they shared their program and their lives with me. And they said dumb things to me like, get a job. Pay your bills. Quit lying. Not a one of those things has got anything to do with my problem. My problem is bad luck and cheap whiskey. And all of these things have nothing to do with my problem. And I told them, I said, I don't think your steps got anything to do with my problem. They said, you don't know which problem is. And they made it very clear to me that there are not very many things that I have to know out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. But that I do have to know that my problem is a lack of power. And that finding that power is what this is about. And they told me that I better understand that a spiritual life is not a theoretical thing. It's something that you've got to get out there and do. The spiritual life is loving in action all the time. And they told me that I better quit fighting everything and everybody because they outnumbered me. And they told me to try to be open-minded enough to be willing to accept the idea that maybe sometime I'd come to understand that God was truly doing for me that which I couldn't do for myself. And they allowed me the dignity of my own mistakes. They allowed me the dignity of my own mistakes. And they spoke basic AA to me. And they were fiercely proud of their fellowship, their society. And they wanted the people out there to think well of us. I walked into the meeting one night and Ben Edgerton grabbed me and he says, "I was in the Highlander today. You owe him some money. Go pay him. It don't look good." He didn't mean that it didn't look good that I owed them money. He meant that it didn't look good that a member of Alcoholics Anonymous was on the edge of being a deadbeat. They were fiercely proud of our society and fiercely protective of it. And they told me about the choices that were mine if I wanted to make it in AA. They told me that if I wanted to be sober, I only need be willing to not drink. That if I wanted to be sober, I need only be willing to not drink. And they suggested that if I wanted to recover, it would only be necessary that I be willing to change. And I said, "Change what?" And they said, "Beats the hell out of us." In those days, people in Alcoholics Anonymous didn't know things, you know. They didn't know stuff. You walk into an AA meeting now and you mention that your liver is on the fritz a little bit and you immediately find yourself surrounded by liver fixers. And people have been places and they know things, you know. And those days they didn't. And they said I had to become willing to change. And I said, "Change what?" And they said, "We don't know, but better remember that up to this point, not one thing you've ever tried has worked. You better become willing to change everything if that's what it takes." They said that if I wanted to become happy and comfortable in the business of living, it would be necessary for me to become willing to live a life based on spiritual principle. And I said, "How spiritual?" Ben Edgerton says, "Hosh, you're going to get spiritual enough because nothing less than enough is going to get the job done." And over the years, I've been out there trying to be spiritual enough. Just spiritual enough to get the job done. As I said, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I believed in a God that was going to get me because He always had. That was the evidence. And over the years, I have come to believe in a God that understands me, and I still don't understand Him, and I don't know anything more about God than a hog knows about geometry, and I just get along. And I was sharing with one of my very special buddies my thing about God that, you know, I don't pray anymore. I don't pray anymore because, you see, God takes care of stuff, and I'm stuff. So my prayers are only of thanks. I thank God today that I was able to be with you. My very best prayer is when I'm driving down the street, I think of someone that I care about and I say, "God, I hope they're all right." But I don't have to pray because God takes care of stuff. I'm stuff. They said I would be spiritual enough. And I've come over the years to believe that being spiritual means most of the time that I just try not to do things I'm ashamed of. Because I don't think that you can separate moral and spiritual. I don't think you can get from here to spiritual, except by way of moral. So I try to live a moral life, and I try to do what I believe is God's will for me, and I think that God wants me to be useful. I think God wants me to be useful. I don't know about your God, but my God gives the same number of points for picking up a piece of trash as he does for saving a baby out of a burning building. So I pick up pieces of trash, and I guess I'd save a baby out of a burning building if the chance came. But mostly I just pick up pieces of trash because I've got a God that wants me to be useful. And I pick up pennies so I'll remember who I am. Pennies are not worth picking up. You cannot in 1 hour's time pick up off the floor enough pennies to make it worth. I could throw out 800 pounds of pennies on the floor, and in 1 hour's time you can't pick up enough of them one by one to make it worthwhile. Picking up pennies is not worthwhile. And I'm walking down the street here a few years ago, and I walked past two pennies on the sidewalk. I took about three steps more, and I stopped, and I said, wait a minute. Just who in hell are you to think that you're too good to pick up a penny? So I went back, and I picked up those two pennies, not because they're important, but because I am. And I want to remember who and what I am, and I want to remember where my power comes from. I got an awful lot of pennies. I don't sponsor people, but I got a lot of little brothers. I got a lot of little sisters, and I ask them two things all the time. Did you call your mother this week? And are you picking up pennies? I assume they've got brains enough to not drink or use, but they forget, you know, to call mothers. Those people around that meeting, the people that I call the guys, my mentors, you know, they told me about things that I needed to know if I was going to live, if I was going to make it. And they told me that my drunkenness, my insanity, my alcoholism was not a moral issue, but that my recovery, if any, was probably going to be. And I said, what's moral? And they said, moral is just living so you feel good about yourself. They said, moral is living so you can walk down the street without looking over your shoulder. They told me in the short term that moral would be just in feeling good about myself. I now know that that's also a spiritual experience. Having fulfilled the conditions to that degree where I just feel good about me, that's moral. Moral is living that quality of life that if you're told you have but a short time to live, you don't have to change anything. And I have been blessed in knowing a few people who, upon being told that they had but a short time to live, didn't have to change anything. They were moral, decent human beings, and that's what I believe the program of Alcoholics Anonymous demands of me this morning, that I become a decent human being. They let me off the hook, though. They told me they didn't know what moral meant to me, and that they didn't care, and it was none of my business. But I darn well better find out what moral meant to me, and I better live that way, or I couldn't stay here with you. They told me I had to quit doing the rotten things that I'd been doing, the scrofulous things. I love that word. Morally corrupt. The morally corrupt things that I had done. I had to quit doing that, or I couldn't stay here in rooms like this with people like you. And I couldn't walk on the sunny side of the street. A lot of times, people ask me, you obviously believe that the program is essentially moral. I say, yes, I do. And they will say to me, but how do you know if it's moral for you? I've got an alarm system right behind my navel that goes off in a nanosecond and says, hey, sucker, you can't do that. No, if I want to do one of those things that I can't do, Chuck used to talk about the things that he couldn't do because he'd run out of time. There are a lot of things that I can't do. There are a lot of things that are legal that I have the moral right to do, but I can't because I don't feel good. So I want to do something that I can't do, and the alarm goes off, says, sucker, you can't do that. Then becomes a cerebral issue. I have to ask myself a big question, could I tell them about it? You know, if I can't tell you what I'm doing, I can't do it. Because if I'm doing something that I can't tell you about, then that secret is a threat to my being part of this herd. And we're herd animals, ladies and gentlemen. We're herd animals. And if I got something hidden that I can't tell you about, something that I'm ashamed of, that becomes a threat to my being part of this herd. People ask me, why do people get drunk? I say, they quit going to meetings. Say, yeah, that's what we've heard. You know what? Doesn't mean a damn thing. We don't care that people quit going to meetings. We want to know, why did they quit going to meetings? Most of the time they quit going to meetings because they were doing something they couldn't tell people about. So I have to ask myself the big question, can I tell you about it? Because if I can't tell you about it, I can't do it. All else fails, my quest for what is morally and spiritually right for me. Look at the ring on the little finger. It's my mother's wedding ring. I asked myself a big question, would Mom be proud of me? Ladies and gentlemen, I'm standing here this morning, safe, sane, and sober. I got on clean shorts, and I'm making it. And by God, I think Mom's proud of me. Thank you.